Stay hungry, stay foolish.
So now on the Innovation Show, it's a great honor to welcome marketing guru, TED speaker, and author of so many fantastic books, Seth Godin. Welcome to the show, Seth.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I love being on Irish radio. It's a special place.
I was talking to you before the show about how to hone this down into a conversation because it's so wide spanning, so many nuggets of information that you've shared with your daily blog, with the amount of books you've done, your audiobooks, your TED Talks, that to hone it down is quite difficult. But one of the books that I love, and I'm going to start with innovation, I suppose, is Linchpin and the mindset of Linchpin and actually just shipping products, not being fearful, standing out from the crowd, to be a heretic and not be afraid of being a heretic. And that comes from tribes. And I'd love to just talk to you about the fact of how to be that within a company. How do you suggest somebody might start to be a heretic or a change maker?
I think we got to go a few steps back. Not too far from where you are is Manchester, England, where the Industrial Revolution really caught steam, if I may. And the deal, which was put into place 120 years ago, was that if you did what you were told, you would get ahead. That if you did what you were told, the company would take care of you. And as Clay Shirky has pointed out, in the 1880s in Manchester, they didn't have coffee bars. They had gin carts that went up and down the streets all day long because so many people were alcoholics. It was so hard to shift from being an independent thinker, a farmer who worked on his own schedule outdoors, to going into a building for 10 or 12 hours a day and doing what you were told. But we bought it. We bought it. And we bought it in the UK. We bought it in Ireland. We bought it around the world. And my argument is the deal's off. That if you work for a company that says we are going to succeed by complying better than any other company, they're lying to you. And we have seen what's happened to the organizations that are built around compliance. They have faded and sputtered and failed. The opportunity, my argument goes, is that at the top of the organization, but also within the organization, we need truth tellers and leaders and the people I will call linchpins. These aren't people who succeed because they obey. They are people who succeed because we would miss them if they were gone, because they contribute something that is beyond competence. And if we can't begin by agreeing that that is needed, then all of my ideas about how to get there are worthless. But I'm hoping, now it's 10 years since I wrote Tribes, I'm hoping that it's starting to resonate with people as they see the creative destruction that's going on all around us and industries turned over, that the deal is broken and that it's up to us to make a new deal.
It's interesting that one of the challenges is the company allowing that. So if you're a linchpin or a wannabe linchpin within a company and you go and you behave like the maverick or the heretic or the change maker and the company suppresses you, what's your recommendation in that respect?
Well, I'm going to begin by saying that in almost every case where I've looked into this, that fear is nonsense. If you work at one of the rare companies that doesn't want someone who cares, that doesn't want someone who gives above and beyond, that isn't looking for someone with emotional intelligence, then you just got a great wake-up call that you should leave immediately. Because there are a number of companies that want someone who does have those attributes is huge and growing fast. What's really happening, though, is that people tell themselves the company doesn't want that because they're afraid. It gives them an excuse to hide. What they're basically saying is, my boss won't let me. Well, of course your boss won't let you, because what you're saying to your boss is, I want to do all this cool stuff, and if it doesn't work, it'll be your fault because you said I should try it. And if it does work, I'll get the credit because I did it. Well, who would take that deal? It's a lousy deal to the boss. So the answer is A, not to begin with huge bet everything innovations, but to begin with the smallest possible steps. And two, to do it without authority, to do it with the willingness to take responsibility. That if you take responsibility for the things that go wrong, but you give the boss credit for everything that goes right, I'm pretty sure you will discover that they ask you to do it again.
There's so much cross-pollination between your books, and you can see your mindset across all the books. Because in Tribes, you talk about this, that you build a tribe, a small tribe, that can have an output or a positive input into the rest of the company. But you got to start, and you got to just get off your ass and start.
Yeah, I mean, so many simple little examples. What would happen to your career if you started a book club at work where every week you and 10 people in your spare time read a book about marketing, business, process, something, right? Would you get fired for that? I think that's extremely unlikely. If only 3 people joined, would that be worth it? Probably. And if day after day, week after week, you grew this circle of people who thought big thoughts and asked hard questions, would that make the organization a better place to work? Of course it would. So why aren't you doing it? It's not because your boss won't let you. It's because you've been seduced into thinking that your job is to be competent. Your job is not to be competent.
Well, I suppose what I was getting at is there are companies that exist that will want you to be compliant. I have a 6-year-old and a 3-year-old boy, and I want them to be free thinkers, and I don't want them to be conditioned to go, this is the way you must do things.
That's right. And so the job of the parent is really difficult, because we say we want our kids to stand out. We say we want to raise free-range kids who explore. But when push comes to shove, we push them to fit in. We push them to get on the rugby team. We push them to do what they're told and not to be the victim of a bully or the scolding of the cool kids, because we want to take care of our kids. But the fact is that training kids to memorize things no longer makes sense, because anything worth memorizing is worth looking up on the internet. And that instead what we need to do is train our kids to have an internal narrative that encourages them to say and do the right thing.
And it's like you said, emotional intelligence, empathy. I had a refresher on Linchpin over the weekend. What you said about being the differentiator, being that customer service guy, being the guy in the taco stand who says, good morning, Seth, every morning, knows what you're having before you even get there, knows that you were missing. And he's like, Mr. Godin, you must have been on holidays. That guy stands out in a world that's coming down the line with AI that's replaceable, rote tasks that will be replaced by artificial intelligence or some systematic change. The outlier will have to stand tall in that world.
Exactly. And yet we respond by tweeting the way everyone else tweets, writing roundup posts the way everyone else does, by being a freelancer just like everyone else is a freelancer, by trying to understand what everyone is talking about and talking about that. You know, this is not our future. Our future belongs to the person who travels to the beat of a different drummer.
With that in mind, can we talk about your career and how you started? Because it's a fascinating story, but also when you kind of know, and this is why I kind of, I suppose, structured the interview this way to go, this is kind of Seth today, but the Seth that started off back in the day with your own agency, etc. Can we talk about that story? Like, because you obviously were an outlier all the time and you thought differently and you backed yourself and you weren't fearful. And it'd be great to understand the story.
Well, forgive me for disagreeing a little bit. I don't think that I was an outlier in many ways. I went to the same public school as everybody else. And in the U.S., that's what we call the school that anyone can go to. And, you know, I went to college with everybody else. When I started, I was filled with fear, and I have been dancing with that fear all along. I think we let ourselves off the hook too easily if we describe somebody who's doing interesting work as different from us. I don't think that's the case. You know, I have failed more than almost anyone I know, and that failure is one of the key elements of my success. Do I see the world differently? Well, I think what I do is I see the world in a non-standard way, but unlike many people, I speak up about it. That there's nothing stopping people from publishing their work online. It's free. There's nothing stopping people from organizing the folks around them. It's free. There's nothing stopping people from putting ideas into the world that don't work. But most people don't do that. I did it fairly early because I was impatient. My parents encouraged me. But, you know, at the beginning, I wasn't seen by anybody as being gifted at this. I was just failing more than they were. And I don't want to let people off the hook because I don't think I'm special.
It reminds me of the Michael Jordan quote about, you know, he succeeded because he took more shots than anyone else. And
there you go.
So, yeah, no, and I love that mindset. And company, I think companies are getting there. They're certainly talking the talk about fail and fail quickly and all that kind of stuff and try small MVPs all over the place. And, you know, some of them will fail and that's okay. But when we move to a world where that's becoming the only way it is, we really welcome that world. How did you get into marketing?
When I was in high school, I was an entrepreneur. And the thing about being a tiny sized entrepreneur is you have to do your own marketing. So to get people to sign up for my ski club in high school, I had to figure out how to get people to sign up for my ski club in high school. And then when I was in college, I started a few student-run businesses. We had a travel agency and a ticket bureau and a snack delivery service and a bunch of other things, each time trying to figure out how to get college students to pay a dollar for a bagel, how to get college students to pay $10 to go see a concert. And that teaches you an intuitive, money-free form of marketing, which turns out is what most people do now. Then I met Jay Levinson, the guy who wrote Guerrilla Marketing, and I wrote four of his books with him, and realized that this wasn't a short-term thing and it wasn't just for small companies. I was a book packager. I came up with ideas for books. And in 1992, before the World Wide Web, I started a company called Yoyodyne that invented commercial email as we know it. And so you got to get one big hit in your career, if you're lucky, and that was mine. My timing was excellent. I ended up joining Yahoo when they bought the company in 99. So for 7 years, we were on the cutting edge of helping big companies not spam everybody. Yeah. And we, you know, we were loud and clear about spam being evil. And I'm really delighted and surprised that email has persisted this long as the key engine of online commerce to this day. But that's because of work that Ted Rubin and Mark Hurst and Jerry Shereshevsky and David Simon and me and others did to sort of pioneer what it meant to engage with customers who wanted to hear from you.
Yeah, and that led to permission marketing. And that was about this non-spamming of customers.
That's right. And the book is still, I haven't updated it on purpose because I wanted people to see how I was thinking 18 years ago. There's a little too much emphasis on games and significant measurable benefits to the consumer. But I think we have seen from Google to Groupon to Pinterest to Reddit and on Forward that these are companies that embrace the ideas in that book.
What I love is what you said there, but it's lasted all this time and that it's still relevant. And another book which you wrote is Meatball Sunday. And I bought this book for so many CEOs and people who asked me for help with their digital marketing. I go, read that and then let's talk. Because, like, let's talk about Meatball Sunday because I use an analogy on this show so many times that our listeners are probably sick of hearing me talking about. But the idea of my company being selling meatballs as its staple product. And then I go, oh, digital's come along. And all of a sudden I throw on a bit of whipped cream and some hundreds and thousands and a few cherries on top. And I have this disgusting product that's false. And it's still widespread, Seth. And I just find that fascinating that so many marketers outsource their brains, and Clayton Christensen talks about this, is that they've outsourced their opportunity to learn, and then the agencies become stronger and they become weaker. And then you have this disgusting product that ultimately the user or the audience suffer from.
Yeah, there's something fundamentally broken about the relationship of most brands with their agency. And the relationship works like this. Here's what we make. We make it efficiently. The factory knows how to do it. Here's some money. Please get people to buy what we make. Well, ad agencies thrived for a long time because TV ads were too cheap. That if you could buy TV ads for less than they were worth, all you had to do was buy a lot of TV ads and you were going to do fine. But now TV ads aren't too cheap. That kind of interruption marketing doesn't pay the way it used to. But there's a lot of smart people left at ad agencies. What we ought to be saying to those smart people isn't come up with a clever ad. What we ought to be saying to them is come up with a clever company. Come tell us what to make next. Come teach us how to behave. You know, so if you think about a company like Volkswagen, I think any ad agency in the world would have said to Volkswagen, don't lie about emissions. And that one bit of advice would have been worth more than all the Volkswagen ads in history put together.
Yeah.
Because what we do is more important than what we talk about. And what we ought to be able to say, if we have a factory up and running, is we made a different product, and the product itself is the marketing. You know, a company like Uber isn't transforming transportation because they have a good logo. They have a stupid logo. They're transforming marketing because they changed what they made. And if you change what you make, the advertising changes, takes care of itself.
Yeah, and it's something that you see in digital marketing so much, in even the product. So they'll half invest in user experience or user interface and not even measure the data, the behavioral analytics through heat mapping or whatever, and instead pour that money into bringing people to a crappy product that they just come to and they go, this is crap, I'm out of here. And like that mindset of your product is your marketing, it is resonant throughout all your books. And I just find it fascinating, Seth, that, you know, you've written some of these books, Tribes 10 years ago, Meatball Sunday around the same time, that they, that's a playbook. That's a playbook that you can pick up and you go, okay, well, I'm just going to follow this and be authentic and be myself and say I made mistakes and admit those mistakes and maybe even make those mistakes into content that I can then use to market my product even further. But I wanted to ask you, said about this, was the rise of ad blocking is huge here in Europe, and it's going to get worse and worse. And what your take on that world is?
Well, the first thing is, why is anyone surprised? If you're busy running ads that people want to block and people can block the ads, why are you surprised that they will? It's not surprising to me at all. So, you know, the idea is advertising on the web has always been flaky. It's been an edge case. No one sits there through an ad waiting for it to be over. They just click to another site. And that's different than TV, where we used to say, well, I got to sit through this ad to watch the rest of my show. And there have been a lot of smart people who have worked hard to get ads that we don't notice or get ads that we won't skip. But there's something fundamentally broken here, which is that advertising by its nature of this sort is interrupting people you didn't expect to hear from when they have a message you don't want to hear.
Yeah.
We can't build an economy on that anymore. TV was a magical moment, but it's over. So instead, what we have to do is sell to our customers, not to strangers. We have to make a product that they want to hear about. We have to turn strangers into friends before we turn friends into customers. We have to deliver anticipated, personal, and relevant messages that people want to get. If we do those things, ad blockers aren't a problem.
Like, even if from your own perspective, I mean, you sell yourself because you are the product essentially. But like, anything you touch almost has a Midas touch because of the authenticity of your content that you provide on your daily blog. I mean, It's phenomenal. I mean, you answered an email to me to do the show, and I did. I emailed you a long time ago when you were putting out for your app. You were looking for a provider for your app, and I said I'll build it for you, and you answered and said thanks. I have a supplier, which was Jacobs Media. Don't mind giving the guys a plug. And I just thought, you walk the talk, so you do what you actually say you will do, and you endeavor to answer your emails, all that kind of stuff. Like, so advertising as a product, so as a media company, my lifeblood now, because my press, the printing press, is dead or is on its way or will become like vinyl in the very near future, or if it hasn't already. And now I'm in an arena where there's no barriers between a blog and a journalist. And in a lot of cases, the blog has so much authenticity and truth and passion behind it, because that's, I'm doing that in my spare time. And how can the media publication survive in a world where A, the product is becoming the advertising, or B, the product team are creating their own podcast or their own advertising through their own blog, and there's going to just be less and less slices of the pie for everyone?
Well, I think there's room for media companies if they can keep innovating on how they define media and come up with things that an individual can't do easily on their own. So the seventh biggest book publisher in the United States also runs conferences that as many as 15,000 people come to in a stadium. Now, they get, I believe, 20% of their revenue from these events. And my expectation is that one day it'll be 100%. You can't run a 15,000 person event in a stadium by yourself. But the tribe wants to meet itself. The tribe wants to come together. The people who want to reach the tribe want them to come together. So everyone benefits from this transition from we own scarce TV spectrum or we have a printing press to we're the organizer of the tribe. And if you're the organizer of the tribe, you don't need nearly as much money and nearly as much as many people as you did when you were a giant organization. But there's no reason to think it's not a valuable place to be. So let me talk in a more general case. Do you have Top Man in Ireland or
sure,
Justin?
Yeah.
Okay. So let's think about their dilemma. They are competing against the Walmarts and the Amazons and the cheapest people in the world. They have to run ads. They have to build stores. They have to do all sorts of stuff to get a new customer like me. So I was having a party for a friend a couple weeks ago. I ordered a bunch of straw hats for everyone at the party to wear. That's a big win for Top Man. They spend a lot of money to get that interaction to occur. So then what they do, because they're racing to the bottom, is they dumped the hats into a plastic bag with no box and no padding and just mailed it to me. So the hats arrive completely crushed and they're useless. So I email the address on the receipt, and 10 minutes later, I get a note back saying, we usually answer emails within 3 days. Well, 4 days later, I get an email saying, we're way behind. We probably won't get to you for 2 weeks. And so they don't answer their email. So then I call the phone number on the receipt, and they don't answer their phone. And I get a recording that says, we're having trouble. We're not answering our phone. And they hang up on me. So here's what they did. What they did was they went to all the trouble to build an organization. But then, because they thought their job was to be cheap, they went in a race to the bottom. But people who buy stuff aren't interested in the cheapest. They're interested in the best for the money. And if everything's the same, then they want the cheapest.
Yeah.
But as soon as you start cutting off your nose to spite your cheap face, then you're on a race to the bottom. And they're going to lose because they won't be able to afford to interrupt new people, to get new customers. They had somebody, me, who they could have figured out how to delight and engage. And then they would have had me again, way cheaper, way, way, way cheaper than it would have cost them to get someone else to take my place.
And it's incredible that is still happening in today, like in today's world, that those experiences are still happening, despite all the literature. I mean, there's nobody reading any marketing manuals there, because like the unboxing as well should be absolutely pleasurable. The whole experience end to end, and we often talk about Steve Jobs and Apple here. that the end-to-end product, from the marketing to the stores, to the unboxing, to the delight of the product, and the being able to just plug it in and play, and the feeling of competence that comes with that, is just missing at so many times. And with retail, when you're seeing so many stores closing throughout the States, and Amazon actually becoming the physical retailer now, you just think that, how can they survive with that mindset?
You know, Aiden, the thing is that it's not a single misguided individual. It's a mistake about who you're working for and what the time frame is. So if we look at a company like Apple, Apple hasn't launched a delightful new experience in more than 2 years. That Apple works for the shareholders, but mostly it works to make the short-term stock price go up. And that means that they're focused on the short term. And if they can shave a nickel, or if they can put something in the software that leads to more money, not more delight, they have done it. And it's pretty clear that they can't do that forever. They could have been an innovator forever, but they can't do this forever, milking the cow. And sooner or later, they will no longer be able to please the short-term people. And the same thing is true with most retailers. Retailers say, well, we're under all this pressure. We have to pay our landlord. We have to pay our investors. So therefore, we're going to go down the short-term path. And we can see it coming, people like you and I, because we're on the outside. We don't see the pressure. We just see the mistake. But this is where creative destruction comes in, is that people make what seems like a rational decision to go after the short term. And in the long run, they're doomed.
And when you compare that to Jeff Bezos and Amazon and just the belligerence to not give shareholders stock because he knows it's like a drug that he'll give them a bit and then they'll just want more, more, more. And he just keeps betting on new futures all the time. Is that what you feel?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the brilliance that Jeff brought to Amazon is he didn't make it the fastest, cheapest place by telling people to hurry up and work for less. He made it the fastest, cheapest place by changing the process itself. And if you change the process, then you can still take care. You know, in the US, Amazon is rated as one of the most trusted, most beloved brands, but they're also the cheapest. That's a miracle. That's really hard to do. They did it by coming up with new processes, not by pushing people to be half the price.
Yeah, and processes, but like innovation in work processes and how do we do this more efficiently, not drive people too much, because there's been a bit back in that negative press over this side of the water about that. But they're constantly innovating everything. And I was an early adopter of Amazon, buying CDs and books. And when I think of the journey from then to where it is now, and you can see the process, and the packaging is like you talk about the Apple unboxing. It's the same with a cheap book. It's just bang, open up, nicely presented, and the receipt is there. And you can just see that, like, it's just end to end within the company to drive those processes.
Right, the company's run by process. The number of people who are book buyers at a place like Barnes & Noble, or, I'm trying to think of a UK brand off the top of my head, compared to at Amazon, is dwarfed, because Amazon doesn't rely on human taste. It's not up to the buyer. It's up to the system. And so the system drives a ton of stuff that they don't have to hire talented people to do, because it's all about the system. Amazon is organized to sell everything. They're not organized to sell a thing.
That's been the beauty, isn't it? I mean, they set up the process for books, then went sideways incrementally into CDs, and then more and more and more, and the desire just to take over the whole thing. And what's your feel on the almost reverse of the retail store? So the physical retail store, and now Amazon has actually put a showcase of a store.
Yeah, that's just a publicity stunt.
Okay, so, well, listen, I'm conscious of your time. I said 30 minutes, and I'm going to stick to that promise. And huge thank you for your time and joining us on the show. And have you any books coming out soon or anything like that?
Well, you know, my book, What to Do When It's Your Turn, is in its fifth printing now, and you can only get it online at yourturn.link. And I am not doing any new book writing, but always special little projects here and there. People can find them on my blog.
And the manifestos, of course, that are all free on the blog as well.
Thank you, sir.
Seth Godin, thank you for joining us.
Be well. Go make a ruckus, Aiden.
Thanks, man.